It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
The Phileas Club is supported by its listeners. If you enjoy the show, please consider going to patreon.com/thePhileasClub and giving a couple of bucks. Hey everyone, this is The Phileas Club number 96 for October 2017, and it's a special on Ireland. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Phileas Club. This is a show where we do two kinds of shows, actually. The regular episodes are those where we get people from different countries and cultures around the world and get everyone to talk about what's been happening in the world, and we sort of get different opinions, different takes on those things. And the special episodes, we focus on one specific thing. That might be a country, it might be religion, or even something else. And this is one such special episode. My name is Patrick Beja, and today we are going to be talking about Ireland. And to help us do that, we have Bart, who is from Ireland. So how are you doing, sir?
I am doing just fine, Patrick. It's an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
I'm very happy we finally get a chance to do this. We've been talking about it for a long time, and we never quite found the time, or in my schedule, I have to admit. I'm the culprit, but we get to do it now, and in a time when there's lots of stuff happening in Ireland, unusual stuff.
Yeah, I got a lot of tweets earlier this week from friends and family on the internet. Well, many friends on the internet all around the world who were surprised to find Ireland mentioned on their news along with the word hurricane.
Yeah. So let's talk about this a little bit very quickly. Then we'll dive into the main course of the show, which is basically I would like you to describe to us what it is like to actually be living in Ireland and what Ireland is. And, you know, get for people who have only seen it through the lens of popular culture, maybe to understand what life actually is there. And it's not going to be as different as, you know, maybe Venezuela, we talked about a few weeks ago, or, you know, other very foreign countries for most of the audience who is Western, I think. But there are still some preconceptions. I'll shower you with some of them later.
Okay, and I'll beat them down. That's okay.
Okay, excellent. But yeah, first, that what's that crazy hurricane thing?
Yeah, so we had a hurricane that went the wrong way across the Atlantic. They're supposed to start in the east, move west, and smash into America. That's you know, the earth spins, and that's what normal hurricanes do. And then on Monday, we had one which came the other way and came. It went east across the Atlantic towards Africa, and then turned north and just went straight for Ireland. Just like poof.
And so how
it hit us.
How bad was it? And also, you're unlike the people on the eastern coast of the US who we hear about a lot and terrible hurricanes, and they're pretty bad, but they're usually accustomed to it. So as bad as the destruction is, they're somewhat prepared. I'm guessing Ireland is not prepared at all.
No, this was a whole new experience.
How did it go?
Well, all in all, it went pretty well. Now, we still have, I think I heard in the news yesterday evening, 50,000 homes without electricity. So it's not that it was nothing, but there were 4 fatalities, which is not a huge amount for a hurricane. So I think, as hurricanes go, I think we did okay. What surprised me, and actually what surprised pretty much everyone, is how well organized our government were. It's not something we're used to saying. So, you know, we had, in fact, the government reacted quite well. So all schools were closed and things like that. And there was, our weather service was great. There was a national emergency center set up. They were constantly on live television from that national emergency center. That background now is etched in everyone's brains. There was really good information, constantly kept up to date, great advice coming all the time. And it was really weird because normally over coffee and work, we discuss how terribly badly the government have messed stuff up. I mean, that's what everyone does in every country, right?
Of course.
We came back into work after the hurricane and everyone agreed that our government did well. And I've never seen that happen before. There's always someone who raises a voice and says, no, they're useless. But no, everyone was like, no, this was handled well.
So is that something that people always say? I mean, the government is bad. I have to say, in Finland, in France, we would say, ah, the government sucks. But, you know, there are some services that we need that they do okay. It's not like, it's interesting. I think it's true that everyone hates their government, but in France...
Yeah, hate is probably too strong a word. It's
The Americans hate their government. For us, it's different. Yeah. For France, it would be like, there can be... It's inefficient, but it's still better to have some, you know, basic things being taken care of and available to everyone than having it messed up in some areas, like, you know, education, obviously the army, police, but healthcare, stuff like that, which is a debate that often comes back. And we get sometimes good service, sometimes basic service. And yes, there are inefficiencies, but it's good that we get them. And then in that context, people complain about it. I think in Finland, people are a lot more happy with the work their government does. I think people are a lot more responsible. So you can trust people in Finland, meaning there is some corruption, you know, some like in every country, but it's ridiculously low compared to the other countries. So even though I'm sure Finns also complain about stuff, in general, my impression is they look at the government and think, yeah, all right, it's not too bad, you know, it's acceptable. So there isn't like, oh, the government is horrible, it shouldn't be handling this or that, and overall. So I'm curious, in Ireland, is it more the American way of, government is horrible? No. Again, I understand in America some people...
No, so it's not that there's an objection to the fundamental concept of government, which is kind of what's going on in parts of America. The belief is that,
I think that's a fair characterization,
Here it's more a case of, we like to complain, and it is always true that no matter what the government do, they could do better. There is always room for improvement. So when you have Irish people getting together over coffee and work or whatever, they will focus on all of the things that are not, that they don't like.
Right.
But if a foreign government or a Donald Trump or someone disparages our government, we will leap to their defense. How dare Tony Blair say something nasty about our government or whatever. So yeah, we absolutely love to complain about them. But at the same time, if someone internationally dares to say a bad word about the Irish government, we'll leap straight to their defense. So it's very much complaining because that's the done thing. And at the end of the day, it's never perfect, right? Because a government is a massive bureaucracy always, and there's always going to be something that's not as it should be. In Ireland, the issue we have is healthcare, but not in the sense that we don't feel the government should do it. Quite the opposite. We feel the government absolutely should do it, and they're not doing it well enough.
Yeah. I think, you know, if we talk about healthcare, that's the consensus around the world. Everyone agrees, except for the Americans, again, who don't know because they haven't tried it. All right, let's not get into that one. Things went well for the hurricane, or, you know, as well as they could be expected to.
Yeah,
I'm guessing people are, I mean, the government's image is going to be improved after this.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure it's going to have a massive effect one way or the other. It was basically everyone was sort of expecting it to be handled badly. It was handled well. That'll be remembered for 5 days or so, and then that'll be forgotten about because that's not as much fun to complain about. And everyone has now moved on because we have Storm Brian bearing down on us, which is going to hit us it's due to arrive here where I am by about lunchtime today, which is why I am keen to get out on my bike and get my exercise in before the weather turns. Right now, the sun is shining and the sky is blue and it's gorgeous, but I've looked on the weather radar. It's really angry south of me and that's on its way.
Wait. The sky is blue, the sun is shining?
Yeah.
You've just betrayed the fact that you're not actually in Ireland. That
here's the thing. No, okay, here's the thing. Right? The first myth is that it always rains in Ireland. That's true and false at the same time. So there's a saying here that if you don't like the weather, you should wait 5 minutes. So there are very few days when it does not rain, but there are very, very, very few days where it rains all day. Hmm. Very few. Like I cycle everywhere. I cycle to work and I get unavoidably wet less than 10 times a year. Usually it's a case of I'll check the weather radar, say, oh, if I leave for work half an hour early, I'll be dry. If I leave at my normal time, I'll get wet. So because we're on the Atlantic, because we're right on the edge, our weather is really changeable.
Mm.
And so most days there is rain, but it's very, very rare that it's just rain. Very rare.
So where are you situated in Ireland?
I am a little inland of the East Coast, so just outside the county of Dublin. So still sort of in the Dublin...
So the suburbs of
psychological
Dublin.
Area, mm-hmm. if you get okay. what I mean, but outside of the actual administrative area.
Fair enough. All right. Anything else about the hurricane? I sort of cut you off a few times.
No, I think that's... I mean, like I say, the big thing here, actually... Well, the other thing that's noticeable... Culturally here, compared to, say, our American listeners, there is zero doubt about the fact that climate change is happening and that we need to start being ready for this. And that's one of the things that every minister was like, okay, so this was, you know, we had our National Emergency Center, we had our National Organizing Committee and stuff. And as much as we don't like it, we need to get used to this. And, you know, there are lessons to be learned and we do better next time. And that, I think they did well. So the fact that they're saying that there's lessons they can learn is great. But everyone agrees we need to get used to this because of global warming. And that's not controversial. That's not people shouting and screaming at each other. That we get it here, right? It's just a non-issue that global warming exists.
I think, you know, I don't want to keep referring to the US, but when we talk about things like this, it's important to note again that pretty much everywhere, just like healthcare, it's an accepted fact. And it bewilders everyone, the attitude of the U.S. in that regard. So, and I'm not even saying this like, you know, pointing my finger and wagging it at, you know, maybe the conservative listeners. It's just, hopefully you come to the show to get... the views of other people, and it's not like just we all have different views. It's just we all agree it's pretty obvious, and we just don't understand how it's different for you guys. But all right, let's talk more about Ireland itself and how things go there. And if you indulge me, I'll say a few things that come to my mind when I think about Ireland.
Okay,
leprechauns.
Oh dear, we're into Paddy Wackery already.
rain.
Yeah, we cover that one.
Catholics, many of them.
Oh, there's so much to say about that.
and you don't have to take them, you know, as they
sure.
exactly as I said them. But so Catholics, terrorism, which is, I understand, you know, Northern Ireland. I'm not sure how
we definitely need to talk about, because much of the world is extremely confused about that whole thing.
Exactly. And probably I have to be fair, I have to say a fiscal heaven for tech companies that want to operate in Europe while paying an unfair share of taxes because their headquarters are in Ireland, which angers everyone, rightfully so. So
that's a complicated one. That's a very interesting one, but that's not a straightforward one because
I mean that one is complicated. That one is complicated, and we might get to it. But I want to get more of the cultural, you know, context of the country and how it's evolved and all of this. Ireland, go.
Well, I guess Ireland is a nation that has changed a lot. So, for a little bit of context, I have, as far as I'm concerned, I have lived, all of my life I remember I have lived in Ireland, but I'm not genetically Irish because neither of my parents are Irish and I myself don't have an Irish passport, despite the accent. I carry a Belgian passport because I was born in Belgium and moved to Ireland at age 4 and I was put into school without a word of English and just let let go. So basically, I came here at the age Irish people start school, and I was just put in school without a word of English. And a few weeks later, I was speaking English with a local accent.
You're talking about school, do you learn? So I learned this basically this morning when mm-hmm. my wife told me Ireland is a bilingual country to an extent. So there's Gaelic in school, or
okay, to an extent. Oh, there is. Yes, technically correct, and that extent is extremely small. But yes, to an extent. So officially, the official first language of this country is the Irish language, as we call it, or Gaelic, as everyone else seems to insist on calling it. We just call it Irish.
Oh,
it's the Irish language. And that is officially the first language of the country. And in fact, if there is an issue with constitutional law and there's a question, what does this word in the Constitution mean? It's actually the Irish version that takes primacy, and that's actually become important in a few court cases. So there is a line in the Constitution that talks about the responsibility of a state towards, using the Irish word, lanav, which is roughly translated as child, but that's incorrect, culturally speaking. The word doesn't imply infancy, it implies offspring. And therefore,
what's
there was a
the
case...
difference?
Well, the case is when you have someone who goes over 18, but is mentally disabled and is still in need of state help, the state would cut them off. And someone made a constitutional claim saying, no, you owe these people care, not only while they're under 18, because the Constitution doesn't use the word child in the English sense. It uses the word child in the lanav. So it's offspring, not child.
Wow, that's fascinating. So... Is the administration operating in Irish? I'll try to be correct then.
Oh,
since
God,
it's
no.
not called
God. No.
So everyone speaks
okay,
English.
Okay, yes and no, right. So officially the first language is Irish. So there are people paid an absolute fortune to translate all of government business into Irish. But if you watch the television, it is all done through English. What might happen is a politician who happens to be a particularly Republican politician will open his speech with two or three words of Irish, maybe a sentence or two, and then flick over into English. The entire country does its business through English, pretty much. There's a few regions, they're quite small, called the Gaeltacht, where they are officially, everything there is done through Irish, and you get massive tax breaks if you go live there, and there's all sorts of rules that you absolutely have to use Irish. But so the official first language is Irish, which is why Irish road signs will have the Irish first and then the English. Now, the Irish is in italics and quite light font, and the English is in a big, bold font. So the English looks more important. That's probably a good thing, or everyone would be lost permanently. But the Irish is first. There's an actual law called the Irish Language Primacy Act, which states that every public body must deliver their services through Irish. So every postman
like
has
as
to...
an option.
As an option. So if you phone up an Irish public service and you say, Conestatatu, they have to be able to answer you back in Irish. Or at the very least, transfer your call to someone who can help you through Irish.
That's funny. It's so similar to the situation in Finland, where there's a 5%, about 5% of the population, which is Swedish speaking. And the official languages of the country are Finnish and Swedish. And my wife is a Swedophone? is a Swedish speaker.
That's an interesting word, yeah.
Yeah. and so it's funny because she's completely lost. I mean, she literally learned Finnish at school. She didn't speak Finnish at home, and she learned it, and she still doesn't speak it as well as Swedish, of course. But even as English, like her Finnish is not poor, but you can definitely tell that she's not a native Finnish speaker when she speaks Finnish, which is for me, who comes from a country where there's only one language that everyone speaks, super weird. And like, for example, our child will be taught French by me, Swedish by her, and not Finnish. Finnish will be a school thing. So yeah. It's like, so I wonder what percentage of the population even speaks Irish as one of their languages?
It's compulsory in school.
Okay.
We all learn it. But the thing is, it's the way most Irish people would describe it is that Irish was beaten into them and it is resented.
Wow.
Which is, then, I think, terrible because the culture, there's so much culture and history there. It would be wonderful if there was a broad love of the language. But there's some serious historical baggage, because under English rule, speaking Irish was basically, or not speaking English rather, was basically the route to poverty and destitution. Mm. And so Irish developed some really negative connotations, where basically it was the language of the poor and the downtrodden. And if it hadn't have been for cultural revival in sort of the late 1800s, early 1900s, the language may well have died out. But there was a very, very active effort as part of Ireland sort of trying to become independent. It was, yes, there was a political movement to break away from England and become a free state. But there was also a cultural movement which was going much, much, much more strongly to prevent the Irish identity from being subsumed into the British Empire. Mm. And an extremely strong part of that is something called the Gaelic Athletic Association, the GAA. And they're the official body for Ireland's national sports, or traditional sports, which are Gaelic football, which is a variant of football that does not exist elsewhere. The closest is Australian rules, which is a bastardized version of it from Irish people who moved to Australia. So it's, the ball is smaller, you're allowed to use your hands in certain situations, it's, some contact is allowed. Then there's another sport called hurling, which involves a very small ball and a very big stick, and many injuries, but a very dramatic game to watch. And so the GAA, and also then literary-wise, there's a very strong Irish culture as well. So people like W.B. Yeats and stuff would have been involved in trying to define an Irish cultural identity. And so a lot of those writers you would have heard of would have been strongly Irish in that way.
So let me ask you this. The Irish language being so important in administrative terms, since, you know, the constitution, you have now, to be able to interpret.
Officially important, right? In yeah, terms of actual day-to-day use, utterly irrelevant, but officially important, and therefore everything is translated.
I understand. But if there's an issue, you need to understand the Irish meaning, which means you need Irish scholars and probably lawyers who do speak the language really well. I wonder, I want to ask you about the relationship to the UK in a minute, but I wonder, do people, regular people, think, you know, yeah, Irish is annoying and, you know, we were forced to learn it and blah, blah, blah. But if you talk about the Constitution, will people say, well, yeah, of course, we need to have the Constitution in Irish, and then all of a sudden there's a swell of national pride and like, yes, this is our identity, absolutely. Right?
So the chests will come out, they'll puff themselves up and say, no, Irish is really important. It's our national language. Do you speak it? No.
All right. But they won't, and not, and no one will suggest, I mean, some might.
Oh, no, it will be suggested.
No one will suggest getting rid of Irish for the Constitution, for example.
That's probably going too far, but there are certainly one of my first most memorable engagements in sort of being slightly politically active in Ireland was in my students' union days, when I took part in a debate on whether or not the state should stop making Irish compulsory in schools. And I delivered the argument that to save the language, Ireland needed to stop making it compulsory in schools.
Oh, interesting. What's your relationship with, should I say, big brother to the east?
It's the elephant in the room permanently, because Ireland's relationship, like Facebook status wise, it's complicated. Doesn't even begin to cut it. So there's some, the practical stuff is easy.
When was independence? Sorry, I need.
When was independence? Even that is not clean cut. So a very, very quick potted history. Mm-hmm. In 1916, a bunch of Irish, very, very romantic Irish patriots got themselves blown to bits in the streets of Dublin and got most of the city destroyed in what's called the Easter Rising. It was militarily a complete failure. Politically, it had almost no support. And then the English literally snatched defeat from the jaws of victory by executing them. And all of a sudden, Ireland had
martyrs.
Well,
they made martyrs out of them, yeah.
They made martyrs out of them, and then they compounded it by having a ruthless roundup followed by internment and basically thousands of people being imprisoned in England with little or no evidence against them, just roundups. And that really, really, really changed things. Because before that, the Irish often held high positions within the British Empire's institutions. They would have been high up in the civil service. They would have been, you know, in India running things and stuff like that. I mean, they were taking part in the empire. There was a lot of condemnation of the Easter Rising right then at that moment. And then by a month after the Rising, complete change, 180 degree flip. And what's worse is this happened during World War One. Remember, 1916. So you had Irish people fighting in the British Army, dying in the trenches, who left as heroes because what England had said was that after the war, Ireland will get home rule. So that is, remain within the British Empire, but have a local parliament like Scotland does now. And so the idea was, we'll go fight for the British in World War One, and when we come back, we'll have our own self-governance. And then 1916 happened and everything changed. And those people came back and they went from being heroes to being the absolute villain of the piece because they were now seen as being collaborators with the evil English.
Oh, the people who went to fight in the trenches?
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's horrible.
It is horrific. It took until the last decade for that wrong to be righted and for those people to get proper government recognition as being heroes and for their treason convictions to be overturned.
Yeah.
I mean, it was such a big deal. The other thing that came out of that that situation is Northern Ireland came out of that. So the Irish people wanted home rule and the British government gave them home rule. And the Ulster Scots, or sorry, the Ulster people in general, were very against Ulster. The northern part of Ireland is called Ulster for very long-running historical reasons. Okay. So if you go back to the pre-Middle Ages, Ireland was four nations loosely held together, and one of them was Ulster. So the four provinces are called. And Ulster roughly coincides with Northern Ireland now, not exactly. And that's where most of the Presbyterian and Protestant Unionists, as we now call them, live. And they were completely against rule from Dublin, because Dublin was seen as Catholic, Popish. And they basically were the first to develop an armed civilian militia and effectively start the terrorism cycle that continued until the 90s. And they were the reason that home rule never quite became a reality. And that struggle was ongoing, and then World War One broke out, and then it all went to hell in a handbasket when the Easter Rising happened. And Ireland came so close to a peaceful departure from direct British rule, and it just didn't quite hold together. And then you had an Irish Civil War. So that's the next phase. So 1920 is the next
thing. Let me interrupt you for just a second. You mentioned terrorism, which I'm sure we're going to get back to, but just as a quick aside, given the context of Irish, you know, is it IRA in English? I never know which one.
Well, the IRA certainly are a major part of that terrorism story. And the Irish Republican Army, IRA.
So a quick aside, how do you look at terrorism, like Islamic terrorism, given the history that your country has with terrorism? Is it any different from maybe what you perceive from other countries, or is it just, you know?
It's very hard to have a typical Irish attitude to these things, because what you will find is it's not such an easy. So the modern jihadist style of Islamic terrorism is universally reviled and detested and feared in equal measure. But there is other Islamic terrorism in the forms of,
I would expect about the motivations rather than the actual perpetration of the act.
The concept of suicide attacks and stuff does not compute. So that, I think that's very much the same attitude as the rest of the Western world. Where things go a little bit more complicated is there's not a sort of as clean a line drawn. All Muslim terrorists are not painted with the same brush, because Ireland has a very strong history with people like the PLO and a history of supporting the PLO against Israel.
Mm. Okay. All right, we might come back to this. I'm not sure, because it's a little bit outside the scope. But all right, keep going with the Northern Ireland.
So, I mean, the origins of it all is a long time ago. So 1916, you have the Rising. It's snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. Irish home rule vanishes into the ether. And now you're left in a situation where the only way Ireland is going to get anywhere is to fight for it. And the Irish do, under the leadership of Michael Collins, who leads a guerrilla campaign of terrorism. let's be frank about it. It was terrorism. It was a guerrilla campaign where they went around murdering British officials in their sleep and in ambushes and blowing up public buildings. It was terrorism. And at that time, it was also called the IRA. But that's a different IRA to the one that reemerges later. And a lot of our history was lost when one of the main administrative buildings, the Customs House, was badly attacked and many records got burned. So a lot of people's genealogy meets a horrible black hole around this time because the records were destroyed. And after a few years of terrorism, a treaty was signed with the English. Basically, a compromise was reached. Negotiations were had in London. Michael Collins negotiated on behalf of Ireland, and they arranged for the Irish Free State. And this is the point in time where someone drew a line on a map and schismed off Northern Ireland. And the offer on the table was that you could not have the whole of Ireland break away, but you would be allowed to have most of Ireland break away, become a free state within the British Empire. So the King of England would remain the sovereign of Ireland, but Ireland would get its own parliament, its own constitution, and basically become like Australia. So very free, but nonetheless, with the head of state still being the British monarch. And because the Ireland was partitioned, it schismed the entire population of Ireland down the middle, schismed families from each other, and resulted in the Irish Civil War. And brother fought brother, this was a vicious, vicious civil war.
But why would they fight each other at that point? Because everything's dandy. You have a free state.
No, you don't. It's schismed. You have the island is partitioned, and there was a pseudo-religious objection to the concept of partition. Mm. Ireland cannot be. It's almost Ireland appears as a character in a lot of literature and stuff in Ireland. The spirit of Ireland, Era, Erin, is almost like a person, and the notion of cleaving Era in pieces. It was like a religious affront. It cut really, really deep. And so you would have one brother who was like, look, you know, the argument pro-treaty was, this is the first step towards full independence and we should take it. This is so much better than what we have now. Yes, this isn't everything we want. Yes, this is not yet a republic. Yes, we still have the British monarch. Yes, we'll still have to swear allegiance to the British crown, but we're going to have massive amounts of self-government. This is so much better than what we have now. And then you had the much more romantic. We're like, no. We keep fighting for what we want. We want a free, independent republic for the whole island of Ireland. And it was a complete schism where you had families splitting down the middle. And the IRA then became an organization which fought against the treaty. And the pro-treaty forces, the official Irish government, were pro-treaty. They won elections and then it really all kicked off. Because once the ballot box had spoken and the anti-treaty side lost, they resorted to violence. Mm. And the violence came to an end when Michael Collins was murdered. And strangely enough, the leader, Eamon de Valera, eventually became president of Ireland. But of the split, partitioned Ireland. It's very strange.
Yeah.
But that division exists to this day. We have two political parties who have the same policies on almost everything, who are both center-right Christian Democrats. And the only difference between them is that one of them was pro-treaty in 1920s and one of them was anti-treaty in 1920s.
Okay. All right. So what's the relationship today, I guess I have to ask a question, with Northern Ireland and with the UK today?
So culturally speaking, the UK and Ireland get on very well. If you ask an Irish person, who's your favorite football team? The answer will be an English team. As far as Irish people are concerned, the league in football is the Premiership, the British Premiership. In terms of television, in terms of all of the culture, Ireland is extremely British, extremely British. But in terms of politics, there is still a strong reactionary anti-British feeling. So our entire court system is English common law that we have basically, when we became independent, we just basically said all the laws that exist now continue to exist and we made a few tweaks. So we still have a British system of common law. Our infrastructure, our railways are all still British. So in many, many ways, Ireland is extremely British. But if you say that to some people, goodness me. So it's an extremely schizophrenic relationship.
Mm.
And politically speaking, for decades, Britain refused to accept the fact that Ireland had declared its independence. And so there was no diplomatic relationship. And so the first time a British monarch set foot in the Republic of Ireland was, I think it was 2012 or something-ish.
Oh, wow.
Basically, it was during the reign of President Obama, because the Queen visited Ireland.
During the
Ireland.
Reign of President Obama? I like how you put
that. Oh, it's the wrong word, actually, yeah. The reign of Queen Elizabeth II, but she's been reigning for so long, that means extremely little. But no, the same year, we had President Obama and the Queen visit. But the Queen's visit was probably the most amazing thing, because that was so full of symbolism. She came here. She went to the memorial to all of the Irish Republicans who died fighting the British and laid a wreath. And she didn't make a speech. She just came. She laid a wreath and she bowed. And it was so dignified and so understated that the country melted. When she did that, the country melted. And then
I
the next
the
day,
Queen doesn't bow very often. Also,
no, exactly.
So, yeah.
And then the next day, our president went with the Queen to a newly refurbished memorial to all of the Irish people who died in the British Army in World War I, and closed that circle when our president laid a wreath with the Queen to those people, those Irish, brave Irish people who died in the trenches in World War I. And that finally brought closure to that horrible issue. And
so
she
gave
a speech in Dublin Castle, and she opened her speech in the Irish language.
Wow.
And there was an audible wow picked up from the mic that should have been off of our president. And it was such a genuine, Queen Elizabeth came here and charmed the pants off the Irish.
I mean,
it was amazing.
I think it kind of shows the we have dozens of histories of things like that in history, but it shows the importance of symbols. And
yes,
it can absolutely change the way a leader acts, can change, can have actual effect on a population and on populations in general. It feels like the relationship you have now is kind of the same one we have, I mean, the French have with Germans. It's kind of like, yes, there's a very, very difficult history there, but mostly we're friends, and, you know, but you'll always have someone who goes like, the Germans, and go like schnell and make some bad taste World War II joke,
yeah.
But we're all very good friends, and we all have like friends from the different countries.
Actually, there's another really good similarity there, because Ireland has an extremely strong trading relationship with England.
Of course,
with Britain as a whole, extremely strong, which is why Brexit is such a catastrophe for Ireland.
Wow, we really should cover that one as well. And again, how it relates. So, just to be clear, Northern Ireland
is we need to talk about
part
that.
Of the UK and not part of Ireland administratively.
It's complicated. Okay.
Damn it. And I non-administrative topics, but let's cover that very quickly.
5 minutes, I'll do my best to explain it in plain English. So Northern Ireland was run up until the 70s by a Protestant elite who gerrymandered the place to Helena Hancart and basically oppressed the Catholic minority. This made the Catholic minority extremely angry. They held what were called civil rights protests, and the British Army shot them. And that was Bloody Sunday, and that triggered the IRA cycle of violence that then went on for 3 decades. And that was the flashpoint that set off that terrorism. That continued for decades with horrible, horrible atrocities on both sides. And eventually, the Good Friday Agreement was negotiated. And that effectively creates two things. It created a bunch of cross-border all-island institutions. So we cooperate with the North on a whole bunch of things. So our national canal network, which is now really a tourist industry rather than anything practical, is run on an all-Ireland basis. We have a whole bunch of these all-Ireland bodies. So that's why there's a little bit of joint sovereignty. The Republic of Ireland used to have in its constitution a claim on the whole island. We held a referendum to renounce our claim on Northern Ireland. And Northern Ireland held a referendum to update their rules so that if there is ever a referendum like happened in Catalonia, if that happens in Northern Ireland, Northern Ireland will leave the UK. So the right to have that referendum is now enshrined. It has never been called and probably won't be for a long time, but the right to that self-determination is enshrined. So if we do have a referendum, we're not going to end up like Catalonia are at the moment. We have that right in Northern Ireland. Northern Irish have that right.
Right. It's interesting that you say we have that right in Northern Ireland. You consider Northern Ireland part of Ireland.
But it is and it isn't. So every Northern Irish citizen, regardless of their political outlook, has the right to an Irish passport and the right to be an Irish citizen if they want to be an Irish citizen. And everyone in Northern Ireland has the right to a British passport and the right to be a British citizen. And they have the right to hold both. So post-Brexit, an awful lot of Northern Irish staunch unionists are getting Irish passports because the dual nationality allows them to be both in and out of Europe at the same time.
That is an amazing position to be in.
Yeah, so every Northern Irish person gets to choose to be a citizen of both countries if they want to.
Mm. Okay. I mean, yes, there would be a lot more to discuss there. But let's... I really want to talk about more social context, sure, dynamics issues. And one of the things, again, my ignorant self goes to, my mind goes to, is, Catholics and impoverished people. In the entire country with rundown towns and, you know, all of that imagery. And I guess we can quickly get the other image, which is taking advantage of the European Union's rules and actually developing a very rich, at least portion of the country with tech. But first, let's talk about Catholic slash. For me, for some reason, they go hand in hand. Catholic, impoverished.
For a lot of the history of the Ireland post English rule, that is a very, very accurate statement. So the initial Irish Revolution in 1916, which, as I say, didn't actually achieve anything at the moment apart from creating martyrs, which eventually led to the full Irish freedom, that initial revolution was extremely progressive. We had strong female leaders. The Irish Constitution was about, you know, freedom. Basically, the state should endow no religion. It was not a Catholic movement, really. It was a humanist movement much more. And so Countess Markievicz is considered one of the heroes of the revolution, and Countess, she was female and she had a military uniform on and she was leading troops. Like it was a revolution for all Irish people. It was not just Irish men. It was for everyone. And unfortunately, what came, the actual Irish Free State that came out of the Irish Civil War was not that at all. What came out of the Irish Civil War was a free country, apart from Northern Ireland, which was still part of the UK, that was extremely patriarchal, and where women's place was in the home, and all of the institutions of government were set up in that way. If you worked for the Irish government and you got married, you automatically lost your job. You were fired. The act of getting married ended your employment. You were to go home and raise those kids. And the church and the government... It was never officially a theocracy. The idea was toyed with to actually put the primacy of the Catholic faith into the constitution, but it was decided against it. And so they did it in deed instead of, so it was de jure instead of de facto, or de facto instead of de jure, sorry. Yeah. So officially, no, there is no Irish state religion. In practice, it was Catholicism, and the bishops were telling the ministers what to do. The bishops were deciding what books should be banned, what movies should be banned, what censorship should be imposed, and the church were given a free run to do all sorts of things. So the church would set up institutions like censorship.
Yeah. You mentioned censorship. Was it really bad, and how long did it last?
The Life of Brian was banned in Ireland.
Really? Well, I guess.
Because radio waves don't respect the border, we just watch it on British broadcasters. So we watch it on Channel 4.
For younger listeners, The Life of Brian is a Monty Python movie that tells kind of the life of a guy in parallel of Christ.
Yeah, I mean, he's not Jesus because Jesus features in The Life of Brian. He's born in the stable next door. But nonetheless... There are, you know, it's clearly,
and that was
it's clearly a commentary. It was, yeah. And that was banned. And that was banned until the late 90s. I watched it the first time it was broadcast on Irish television. And then the song from that movie when they're all nailed up on the cross, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, that became an Irish number one hit for weeks and weeks and weeks, but they beeped out the word S-H-I-T. When life's a piece of beep.
Right, okay. You can say it on this show, it's fine.
Okay, so when life's a piece of shit when you look at it. I mean, it's a lovely rhyme. It's a wonderful line. But that was beeped.
Okay.
So that gave you some idea. And that was in the 90s. So yeah, there was a lot of censorship. And there was also a lot of rebellion against it. There was an author who went by the pen name Flann O'Brien, who remained anonymous until after his death, but he was actually an Irish civil servant. And he rebelled by writing whatever he wanted to write. And, you know, a lot of stuff was in the underground and so forth. But it was a real, real issue. If you didn't think that the woman's place is in the home and so forth, society was really out to get you. Single mothers in Ireland had a really bloody hard time of it. And the worst of it was that the Catholic Church were allowed to create institutions like schools, orphanages, and the absolute worst kind were homes where single mothers would be hidden in and horribly abused until they had their babies and then sent home and everyone pretended it never happened.
And Magdalene did they keep their babies?
No, they were forcibly removed and sent for adoption to America. So basically, Americans would come in and pay the church for a baby.
Lovely.
And all of this was done with, at the very, very, very least, the government choosing to turn a blind eye. At the very, very, very least. But in reality, many, many ministers were very actively supporting this because it basically meant that the government could offload their social problems to the Catholic Church, who would lock these kids up in these horrific institutions. And that is the source of these spectacular scandals that utterly destroyed the Catholic Church's hold over Ireland.
Yeah, you mentioned this in a previous episode of the show a while back, and maybe we should dive into it as well. But so I do want to ask, you mentioned censorship and, you know, until the 90s it was still. But was like the Life of Brian being banned, for example, a holdover from the 70s that really doesn't illustrate the context of the country in the 90s? Or was it still, were there things getting banned in the 90s?
Oh, no, there were things getting banned all the time. Movies with scenes cut out. If you were to watch the movie in RTE, you would be missing any scene that had even the vague. Okay, there was a scandal, and I mean a scandal in the nation in the 80s, when Ireland's most famous soap opera, it's called Glenroe, showed a married couple in bed together having a chat. There was no flesh visible. But they were in the marital bed, and that was shown on television, and that was considered a scandal. Glenroe were earth-shatteringly brave to show that scene.
Okay, so I guess things changed with the Catholic Church scandals you mentioned in a previous show. We could go over them, but before we do, how does this relate to the poverty, if at all?
I don't think Ireland has there is poverty in Ireland because there's poverty in every country, but Ireland isn't a particularly unequal country as Western countries go.
Okay, now,
maybe
so
I'm comparing to America, which I shouldn't do.
Yeah, that is an image I have, which is inaccurate. Some of them.
Well,
have
okay,
been
it depends. So,
but
what time scale are you talking? Are you talking about the last few decades, or are you talking about the first half of the 1900s? Because
no,
they're
I'm
very,
talking
very
about
different stories.
I'm talking about the last few decades, where economically, in my imagination, I guess the country was struggling. And maybe comparing it to, or maybe even confusing it with some regions of England and the UK, where the country was running, or the local towns and such were running on factories or mines or whatever, these kinds of things, and then things. They were poor already, and things collapsed, and things didn't go well, and there was a significant lower, income per capita than there would be in the rest of Western Europe. That is an inaccurate.
Not completely, but not to the same extent as the UK. So, I guess the early Irish state was extremely insular, extremely inward-looking, protectionist in its outlook. And that resulted in a country that was poor. The entire nation was poor. It was poor as a country, and there was a lot of poverty throughout the country.
Okay, so that's not completely inaccurate then.
No, that is certainly true. But that is many decades ago we're talking. So that is 50s, 60s.
Okay, so
and
not
80s.
Then
an 80s. Active decision was made. Yeah, an active decision was made, which took time, right? It wasn't like we flicked a switch and everything changed. But there was a 180-degree policy shift, which leads us towards the current tax stuff, where basically the government just decided, no, we're going to do the opposite. We're going to have an extremely open economy. We are going to have extremely competitive tax rates. We are going to set up state bodies whose sole responsibility is to attract foreign direct investment, something called the IDA, the Irish Development Association, I think is the A, who went around the world and actively courted businesses, made deals with them, brought them into Ireland. And that is what gives you the Celtic Tiger. That is what, over the decades, built up to Ireland becoming a booming economy.
When was that decision made? Do you know roughly?
That decision would have been, it was before I was born, so you're talking 70s, 80s. But it was slow. It was a mindset that took a long time. The closed mindset didn't vanish overnight. It wasn't a eureka moment. It was a slow, as older politicians fell away and they were replaced by younger politicians, the mindset shifted. The mindset of the civil service shifted very dramatically. And so it took time to build up steam. And a big part of it was joining Europe in the late 70s. So joining the EEC as it was then, the European Economic Community. And Ireland is an example where European support it had grip, it had leverage, it actually achieved things. So the European Development Fund created the infrastructure that allowed Ireland to turn itself around economically, to become a nation you associate with high tech. I mean, that was just so ridiculous to think about that in the 60s or 70s, Ireland and high tech. That was like that would be a preposterous thing to say. Ireland was a place of poor farmers insular and backward looking. And so, now Ireland is a hub of banking and tech.
So and to me, because I know tech, I associated with, you know, the tech giants. In France, we call them the GAFAM, which is Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, and Microsoft. And
they're
so
all
we have
logos
an acronym
I see on buildings around the greater Dublin area. Yeah, I live in a place that's called Ireland Silicon Valley. It's in along the River Liffey in sort of Leixlip Lucan, that sort of area. We had HP there closing down, unfortunately, but we have Intel here, Dublin City Centre. You're going to see Microsoft, Oracle. Well, you're not going to see Oracle anymore. Sorry, you are going to see Oracle. You're not going to see Sun Microsystems.
Because of the tax breaks, obviously, but they are a symptom.
No, it's not only the tax breaks. Let's set that one straight, too. But the other thing, so Ireland invested in its infrastructure, and a major part of that infrastructure is education. Ireland has a workforce which is extremely well-educated and is extremely effective. So we don't work as long of hours as Americans, but we are more productive than Americans. So if you ask a company like Intel, who have factories all over the world, the Irish workers do not work the longest hours, but they are extremely efficient workers.
That's a misconception about France as well. A lot of people think that French people are lazy because of all, you know, the striking and the demonstration and all of that. But the efficiency, I guess, the productivity of French people is pretty high. It's not enormously high. It's not the highest in the world, but it's also high. So even if you work less, you're going to be efficient. But so education, and I want to go back to that, but that part of it came in the tech part of it came in the 2000s.
No, it would have been
before
earlier.
That. Okay.
It would have been earlier. So Intel has been in Ireland, I think, since the 80s.
Okay. So it started before. You're talking about the productivity and education, and I cut you off. What other factors would you attribute this to, which I don't see?
I think the education is a huge one. So the ability to come here as a high-tech company and hire people at a reasonable rate. I mean, our cost of living is not low, and we have our labor protection and stuff is much, much, much stronger than you will have in America. It's not up to French levels. I think if you imagine America and France as the two outliers in terms of, you know, the balance of workers' rights and sort of this culture of working to live instead of living to work. Or, you know what I mean?
There would be stuff to say there. There would be stuff to say there, even for France, which I'm discovering is not, you know, there are some peculiar things there as well. But let's take that as a base.
Yeah, so imagine Ireland as being in the middle. Ireland is in many ways a mid-Atlantic sort of place.
Let's take an example just to illustrate this. If you lose your job, how much unemployment benefits do you get for how long?
It depends on how long you had that job.
Okay. So there for a long time, like the maximum amount.
It's basically for every so many years you work, they have to pay you so many months of full wages. I don't have the exact numbers, but if it's a voluntary redundancy, the chances are you will have a few years worth of income, at least a year or two's worth of income as you leave the door. If the company goes bankrupt, you'll have less. But if you've been working there for a long time, you're going to have a few months worth of income as a bulk sum, most probably. And then you're going to get to go on to the first level of unemployment benefit here is called Job Seekers Allowance. It is not means tested. So when you lose your job, you get 6 months of unmeans tested government benefit. And then after those 6 months,
by means tested, you mean they test the means by which you're looking for a new job, or?
No, as in your other income doesn't matter. So means testing.
Oh, that's financial. That means. Okay. Your means. Okay.
Yeah. So it's not means tested. It is automatic for the first 6 months. And after the first 6 months, it becomes means tested, which means that if you have income from stocks and shares or whatever, if you're basically financially well off, even though you're unemployed, it will cease. But if you are not, if you lost your job and you have lost all of your income, you will continue to receive benefit. So it switches from being job seekers allowance to job seekers benefit. And you can receive that indefinitely. But they do require you indefinitely. You will receive benefit indefinitely if you have no income.
That is like, but it's a lower amount, right?
It's a lower amount. It's not good living, right? It's not. Don't imagine you're living on the pig's back. It's not a lot of money. And you will have to continue to provide proof that you're seeking a job. So you will continue to have to say, every few months you'll be called in for face-to-face, where you will have to show rejection letters.
Mm. So in France, for comparison and context, we get 2 years worth of unemployment benefits, which amount to about 75% of your before-tax income. So about 50% of after... 50% of before-tax income, which is probably about 75% of after-tax income. Yes. And that's about 2 years, and it is also not means tested, I would say, for the beginning. That I'm a little bit fuzzy on. But then after 2 years, it will stop, and you will have to get on, if you want to, on something different, which would be like the basic wage living help, which would be about 500 to 600 euros a month, which obviously is not going to allow you to do much unless you live in a very, unexpensive countryside part of the country. And even then, it's not easy. The unemployment is about 2 years. So I'm not sure you're so in the middle between the US and France. It seems to me you're much closer to France. But
In Ireland, socialism isn't considered a bad word. We have had center-right politicians stand up in the lower chamber of our House of Parliament and proudly declare themselves socialists. Now, they got laughed at because they were actually, by Irish standards, a very right-wing government. But by American standards, they were loony lefties, I think. But by our standards, they were considered right-wing, so they were laughed at. But it was considered something that they should aspire to. Yeah, we might be a right-wing party, but no, we're still socialists.
Mm. So, education, social policies, I guess healthcare could enter into that as well. I'm curious about women's rights, which you talked about a little bit.
Yes.
Surely that doesn't help for the economic development when it's done the way you were talking about it before.
Right.
Has that
changed?
And
it isn't anymore. That changed dramatically with, public bra burnings, and that was a big deal. When I was growing up, that was a big deal. So my mother-in-law would have been a civil servant who successfully fought to keep her job when she married. So she would have gone through the court system to fight for that right. And she progressed in the civil service to an extremely high level and was basically smashing her head through glass ceilings for her entire career and ended up being one of the very highest officials for a female minister for enterprise, trade and commerce, I believe. So that really changed. So to give an example, one of the big quote unquote political battles that were that I watched was in my school. We were in a mixed school and girls wanted a right to wear trousers. And it was my classmates who fought for that and won. And so the whole time I was growing up, you had all of these antiquated notions being challenged and being smashed. So we don't have nearly enough, because there should be half of our ministers should be female and half of our parliament should be female. It should be representative.
Sorry, again, I'm going to interrupt again. I do that a lot, but I think it's for specific questions. I don't want to move on too long before I can ask them. How does, again, if the Irish people look at the, I don't even want to call it the controversy because it was whipped up from almost nothing, but that kneeling thing in the US, you know, the NFL, where some people feel it disrespects the flag and some people feel it's like a way of expressing your concern about things that is nonviolent. And, you know, if you can't do that, then...
I think the feeling is Donald Trump is trying to distract people from everything else that's wrong. That's how it's viewed here.
Okay. Fair enough.
It's just laughable. It's considered absolutely preposterous.
Okay.
To get back to the issue with female. So do remember that for much of my life, the president of Ireland has been female. We had Mary Robinson, was our first female president, who went on to take a very high role in the UN. She was Commissioner for Human Rights. Followed by two terms for Mary McAleese, who was a Northern Irish female president of the Republic of Ireland, because everyone in Northern Ireland has the right to Irish citizenship. So she was from Belfast in Northern Ireland, technically part of the United Kingdom, but she was president of Ireland for 14 years. And she hosted the Queen. She was our president when the Queen came to visit. So when the Queen visited Ireland, our head of state was female and their head of state was female. I mean, I won't say that we're in a perfect situation. We still have the same problem we have everywhere. It is illegal to discriminate based on gender. And yet, when you look at the average lifetime income of a woman versus the average lifetime income of a man, there's still a discrepancy there. So we have the same problems many other countries have, where it's not overt sexism. It's some sort of cultural issue where there's an assumption that women will not progress as far. I don't know what it is exactly. I wish I could put my finger on
We'll have a discussion with a few women about this at some point in the future, so we'll cover that, I'm sure.
But I don't think we're particularly qualified,
really. Yeah, exactly. But so maybe people haven't listened to that episode where you described what happened with the Catholic Church scandals, so maybe go over this very recently and then we can talk about other things.
So for years, because of this close relationship between the church and state, any allegations of wrongdoing were covered up. And so you had a culture of cover-up. You had a culture where rule one, protect the church and the state. Rule two, consider maybe protecting the kids. So you had abuses of, they fell into a few categories. So one of the abuses was physical abuse. You basically had kids being beaten to death sometimes in these ridiculously draconian, particularly the church-run centers for child criminals, whose crime may have been something ridiculously small and silly that really, really didn't warrant them being locked up. Also, unfortunately, in orphanages, in state-run or in church-run schools. And you had amazing abuse of, like, amazing in all the wrong way, like, just heartbreaking abuses of single mothers in the so-called Magdalen laundries, where they had their children taken away. And it was just covered up, covered up, covered up, covered up. And about 20 years ago, the dam burst. And so you had the church doing things like moving.
So mid to end 90s.
Yeah. Mid to end. Yeah. Yeah, exactly then, actually. So, yeah, as I was leaving secondary school, so exactly then. And you had the church doing things like moving known paedophiles around on the flawed theory that it will take them time to groom new victims. So if we just move them around often enough, it'll be grand. Right? I mean, it was nuts. And so you had a few brave people coming out and making allegations. And the initial response was, how dare you attack our beloved church? And as those brave first few people made their cases to the police investigated, and priests started to be arrested and incarcerated. So as the testimonies came out and the heart-wrenching stories came out, the dam burst.
What made, you know, I think we've had these stories everywhere, and I think the Catholic Church has started in most places to finally do something about these. But mm-hmm. I'm not sure, you know, we had stories forever. And again, not to make a comparison that we can't mm-hmm. really comment on too much because of who we are, but there are stories about sexual assault on women, and there have been for mm-hmm. a long time. And we're not quite at the point where things are actually bursting in the world.
Well, but with the Harvey Weinstein thing, we're starting to see that, right?
Yeah, I think that could, well, the future will tell, but it could be a breaking point, at least one of them for sure. But so, I guess what happened for the Catholic Church in Ireland that made it into such a big scandal that, as you mentioned, it broke the hold, the incredibly strong hold that the Catholic Church had on the country. And why did people who I'm guessing were very much Catholics and believers and, you know, trusted mm-hmm. the church, what made them essentially renounce their lifelong beliefs? You know, it's not something
easy. Okay, haven't renounced their beliefs, right? So what you have is people who feel their love of, I mean, I'm not religious myself, so apologies if this doesn't sound the right tone, but their love of Jesus is unchanged. They still see themselves as Catholic. They see the bishops as illegitimate, evil, not to be trusted. So the church hierarchy is broken. But Jesus is
good. I think it's similar to, and I'm not going to talk about the US for once, mm-hmm. what we see in politics in many countries when a party is either, you know, defeated or seen as inefficient or, you know, even corrupt sometimes. Mm-hmm. Some people can still hold the ideal of the party as something to be, you know, sought after.
Sure.
But I think that's the right reaction. And in the context of the Catholic Church, I think the right reaction would be, well, you know, Jesus, awesome. And he's a pretty good dude in my book. I think he preaches for, you know, he advocates for some.
Do unto others incredible, as you would have others do unto you. I'll take that. Yeah.
Yeah. And there are many, many of those in the good book. But the quote-unquote bad reaction is to staunchly remain by the side of the offenders. And in politics, yes. You see that all the time. I mean, we saw this in our French election, and it happens everywhere. It's just one example when we had very clear examples of wrongdoing on the part of one of the candidates, and people were just, they kept defending him and going like, oh, this is, you know, being fabricated. And it's like at some point you... And so I'm not sure in that story of the Catholic Church, can you identify at all what broke the camel's back? Like, how did it turn into?
It just kept coming. It was scandal after scandal after scandal. And what was worse was that every time there was a detailed report done, what came out was that it went higher and higher and higher up the hierarchy. It became more and more organized. It went from, you know, people running a local parish to people running a diocese to people running an archdiocese to an order from the Vatican saying that canon law should take primacy over the nation's laws, and if at all possible, it should be kept within the church, and the authority should be actively cut out. We should not report crimes. And then horrific things like bishops sitting there with children basically saying, yeah, we know what happened to you. Terribly sorry about that. you now need to swear silence on pain of eternal damnation of your soul. So using the kid's faith against them to mentally torture them into secrecy. Mm. And it was so perverted and so twisted, and it was against kids. It was too much.
It certainly, that seems like a powder keg. Like, we don't see a lot in the world, but not to comment more specifically, I think this is interesting when we're thinking about injustice in general and the structure of power perpetuating those injustices. And in that, you know, again, everyone will hear this and think, maybe they're talking about this thing, or maybe they're addressing, you know, they're secretly want to target this thing that I have this or that opinion about. But really, I'm not sure that's the case. I think it's a great example of a structure of power, just in general, protecting the injustices that it perpetrates. And we look at this, and it's very easy to think, well, yes, obviously physical and, you know, sexual abuse of children. Oh, how could we ever, of course, you know, I would never do something like that, like defend the structure of power that protects injustices. I would never do that. But this is different. You know, what we're talking about here is different, whatever the issue of the day is, be it, you know, slavery back in the day, or, violence against black people in the U.S., or whatever it may be in any part of the world. But I think it's really important to keep in mind what it's just one example. There are many which you're describing that today we look at it and are horrified. But I guarantee you that back in the day, many of us, I'm not excluding myself from this, might have looked at it and thought, oh, well, you know, it's just one person. You know, it happened once. Or, you know, that person, they're saying this, but it's not true. Or, like, they're lying. Mm-hmm. They're trying to get, you know, all of those things. And I guarantee you that many of the people, again, myself included, possibly, who are now looking at this and say, how could they? Outrageous, you know, like all of this, mm-hmm. might have just excused it, or because that's just how humanity works.
And right, so that's why I'm saying it. The reason it led to where it did is because that initial reaction was there, and then another scandal came out, and another, and another, and eventually it's just a few bad eggs or a few bad apples. It breaks down in just this,
which is why it's so important. It's so important to keep speaking out and investigating and letting, you know, people do their investigative job. And
and the more stories came out, and the more reports that discovered, it was basically the cover up. It was as details were released about the cover up, the bad apples argument just melted away.
Right. And now, to talk about modern Ireland, I guess this did shape the country into what it is today. How is Ireland today? We talked about the history of the country a lot. We would need another hour and a half, which we don't have, to talk about Ireland today. But
I would say Ireland is actually quite a progressive and open country. So Ireland was the first nation on planet Earth to have a referendum which ratified gay marriage by popular vote. The majority of Irish voters voted in favor of gay marriage. Now, you can make the argument, and I would have made the argument, that putting minority rights to a popular vote is not actually appropriate. But leaving that whole discussion aside, as a nation, the majority of Irish people supported gay marriage. That is amazing when I remember the Ireland I grew up in the 1980s. Mm. That's not the same country at all.
And economically, like, how do you
economically get around? So Ireland is
except for the Silicon Valley. How is it called? Silicon Valley Ireland?
The Ireland Silicon Valley. Yeah, we just say we're in Ireland Silicon Valley, but it's the whole nation. Like, if you pick any part of Ireland and you now say, how are you doing now compared to 40 years ago? The answer is much, much, much better. So an awful lot of investment has been put into the whole country, but that does not mean it's equal. So it is highly, highly Dublin-centric. So the government sits in Dublin. Most of the large industries in the greater Dublin area and Cork. So Ireland has sort of two main cities, Dublin and Cork.
Yeah, actually Blizzard Entertainment has their offices in Cork.
Yeah, and the pharmaceutical industry in particular is extremely strong in Cork.
Just for context, 6 million people in the country and about 500,000 in Dublin and yeah.
Yeah, so I mean Dublin skews everything. And because Dublin built out instead of up, that sort of in Dublin isn't only in Dublin. There's a ring of counties around Dublin that are effectively in Dublin. So I'm in County Kildare, but it's effectively Dublin. It's not administratively Dublin, but it's effectively Dublin.
So do people go to Dublin if they want work? Or?
Yes, and that is part of the reason why we still have this divide, because people who live out in the rural parts of Ireland, if you want to get on in life, you go to university, which means that you leave your rural environment and you spend 3 to 4 years in one of the Ireland cities, Dublin, Cork, Galway, Limerick, Waterford, wherever.
But you're moving away, right?
Free tuition, but there's more cost involved than just tuition. Going to university is not cheap, but you don't pay your tuition.
Right, that's what I meant. By education.
You do pay a registration fee of €1,000-ish, I think it is these days.
That's right. Yeah.
So it's gotten very muddy, but effectively free tuition. And then when you come out of university, you then go look for work. And what you find is you do not go back to where you came from. So I grew up in rural Ireland on the border with Northern Ireland in a place called County Cavan. I did not go back. I'm a family of three kids. I didn't go back. My youngest brother didn't go back. My middle brother is the exception in our family. He went back. He went to university in Dublin and came home. But the rest of us didn't. And that is repeated in every family we know. The vast majority leave for university and do not come back. You have a massive brain drain out of the rural areas.
And are they in disarray or is it not that bad?
It's not disarray. What it is so the Irish government does a lot of investment, and an awful lot of European investment is done in the poorer parts of the country, in the rural parts of the country. So you will see good road networks, and the intention, what they're striving for is to pull industry into those regions by providing infrastructure first in the hope it will pull investment in. It hasn't failed, but it also isn't a success.
Do they have internet wiring everywhere? Or
that is an ongoing issue. That issue is being resolved, but too slowly.
Mm, okay.
So yes, they have internet, but no, they don't all have broadband. And the intention is that within the next 2 years, they will all have broadband, but it's too slow.
That's necessary, right? If you want to...
Oh, vital.
I mean, at this point, you can't just have roads if you don't have fiber everywhere.
Exactly.
It's not happening.
It is happening, but it's much slower than a lot of people want. And I would say it's much slower than it really should have been, because during the Celtic Tiger, Ireland had the money. And that was the point in time when it could have been done. Mm. And it wasn't done enough.
I think this is one of the, from what I'm seeing, one of the problems is either you have fiber in your countryside, and I'm looking at Finland, mm-hmm. and we do in many areas, and then it's possible for people, for remote workers, for small companies, for, you know, to just go and do their business from there. And you have either roads or trains, and you can just go to the big city when you need to, once or twice a week, if that, work from... And if you don't have fiber... then it's not even a question. It's just not possible. Yes. So it really annoys me and pains me when people in every country don't, you know, realize how much of a vital investment in your future economy fiber is, and when interests prevent this from happening. And I did want to ask about Brexit and how... I mean, it seems from everything you're describing, it seems there wouldn't be a single soul in Ireland that would be anti-EU. But How do you look at Brexit?
Okay, Ireland's relationship with the EU is awfully similar to Ireland's relationship with our own government, right? We love to complain about silly things the EU does. And at the same time, as we drive down our roads, we see these massive blue signs everywhere with those gold stars saying that this road you're driving on now is EU road, this railway track you're on now is an EU railway track. I mean, it's everywhere
EU
here.
Road, the Irish government. By EU road, you mean everything
in Ireland funded by the EU? Or part funded by. So it's never, the EU don't hand you a free check. The EU basically say, go develop a project, find most of the financing, and we'll throw in a bit. So EU structural funds have been used have been involved in the building of an awful, awful, awful lot of infrastructure here. And the Irish government have a policy that if EU money gets used, a giant, big, massively tall sign in blue with the EU logo on it gets put up to say this was part funded by.
Why do we not have this? Why do we not have this in France? We should have this everywhere in the entire EU.
Yes, we should.
I mean, for God's sake, they should have this. When the government does something in the US, they should have a massive sign saying it. It seems so obvious. And we have an anti-EU sentiment in France. And sure, we'd like to complain about it as well. But I'm certain that if we had knowledge of the investment and help EU does for us, it would be not disappear, but it would be diminished. But anyway, sorry.
So the fact that it is so visible, that blue logo is so visible. And so it's not just the EU logo on those signs. So the Irish government's various. So if, let's say, the National Roads Authority, then their icon will be on it. If it's done by a certain contractor, their icon will be on it. So everyone involved in the project gets their billing. It's not only the EU who get advertised. But everyone involved in making this bridge a reality, or everyone involved in making this motorway a reality, is on that big sign. And those gold stars on that blue background are all over the place. Now, the point where things might change is when France and Germany start to say that Ireland needs to change its tax rules, we start to get much, much, much less pro-EU. And one of our biggest allies in that was the United Kingdom. So the United Kingdom and Ireland were often very much allied. Now, the thing is, when it comes to agricultural policy, the Irish and the French are very much allied. So it's not... It's not simple. We don't have... It's not like Ireland against the EU or Ireland against France. It's on some issues... Ireland doesn't agree with France and Germany. On some issues, Ireland doesn't agree with Germany, but it does agree with France. I mean, it's very, very, very much more nuanced.
Mm. But, so
as
what
a
about,
whole, the Irish, the Irish are not, and the Irish, in general, the Irish opinion is, what the bleep were the British thinking? Really, I mean,
for our British listeners.
We came in to work... the morning after the Brexit vote, and it was a stunned silence with lots of people mouthing like goldfish, going, what the, but, we consider them absolutely nuts.
Mm. Okay. I guess that answers my question.
That answers that question,
All right. Well, as I mentioned a couple of times, we could be talking about all of this for a very long time. But you do have to go and bike before your storm hits. So anything else you want to mention before we close off the show about the country and something important we might have missed?
I would just say that something we haven't talked about is the physical country. I would say that if you haven't been to Ireland, consider coming here because... physically, it is actually an extremely pleasant place to be because there are almost no extremes here. In the winter, it's less warm than in the summer, but it's not cold. In the summer, it's less cold than in the winter, but it's not really all that hot. We, with the exception of one hurricane, we tend not to get weather extremes. We don't get earthquakes. And the natural landscape, there is so much beauty in this country. It's not like... Himalayan mountains. It's just a gentle, subtle beauty. Everything is lush and green. It's a very peaceful sort of countryside with rolling hills and a lot of green. And even our mountains are really quite low as mountains go, but they're very beautiful. And our coastline, the Atlantic coast is a bit rugged, I'll give you that. But it is a country without massive extremes, but extremely beautiful and very welcoming. So I would say if you haven't come over because it's a lovely place to be, and the people will be delighted to see you.
Sounds like there's a lot of pride in your
country. An awful lot of pride, and we have history here. Like, you can go to the Hill of Tara and stand on the place where the High Kings of Ireland were crowned thousands of years BC. And you have a feeling that this landscape has been alive for thousands of years. If I go out on my bike, I will pass by probably 20 historical monuments today without even trying. Because it is a landscape that has been alive for millennia. And you feel it here. It's a country with a rich, rich history.
I guess if I try to think of Ireland in non ridiculously disparaging ways, I would think of a small castle on an island on a lake somewhere.
It's a bit more Scottish than Irish. We're not big on our castles here. But a lot of Stone Age, Iron Age, like, you know, ring forts, hill forts. It's not that we don't have castles, but we don't tend to focus on them as much because they come with a caveat that they're all English. Right? Who was building the castles and why? Oh, sugar, you know?
Okay, I guess that does make sense. All right. I guess that is going to be it.
As I say, we could talk forever you could do a 10 episode special on Northern Ireland. And I don't know how many episodes you could do on Brexit. I mean,
well, we've done a few already.
This is a complicated place.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you very much for being on the show. And before we leave, of course, as always, would you mind telling people where they can find more of you? Because you're a prolific podcaster yourself.
Oh, thank you very much. I think the easiest single link to give out is bartb.ie because no one can spell my surname, so I just went with bartb. And I do host two of my own podcasts. So they're the Let's Talk series of podcasts. So Let's Talk Apple is a monthly show where we take the big picture look at Apple news. So we step away from the day-to-day minutiae and try to look at the big picture. And then Let's Talk Photography is about the art and craft of photography, not about the technical minutiae of do I buy this lens or this model of camera, that model of camera. No, it's much more about the bigger picture stuff there too. So they're at let's-talk.ie.
Excellent. I will have the link to your Twitter account, to your Twitter account in the show notes, of course. Excellent. As always. For me, it's Not Patrick on Twitter. You can find this show at frenchspin.com, where you will also find Pixels, which is a show about gaming. If you want to help us out, you can do one of two things. Go to iTunes and leave us a comment and a review. That would be very much appreciated, as it does help people find the show. iTunes or any other, podcast app and catalog that you use. And if you really want to help us out, why not head over to patreon.com/thePhileas Club, which is also linked in the show notes, and where you can support the show financially. You can give us, the amount of a coffee or a beer every episode, and that, of course, helps the show be created, because that's how I make a living. So if you think the show is worth something, then maybe consider going to patreon.com/thePhileas Club. It would be very, very much appreciated. So thank you in advance for considering it. And that's going to be it for today's episode. We will be back probably in about a week with a regular episode. And it should be an interesting one. We hope to talk to you there. Bye.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.